Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to this edition of CNS News. I'm your host, Carl Massman.
And I'm Patty Espinosa. Today I'll be out on the streets talking to people about some of our stories.
In our first segment, San Francisco may soon give its poorest youth a cheaper way to get around.
Then later, the Hmong community says goodbye to a beloved leader.
But first, Emily Bender speaks with the local Muslim community about the uprisings in the Middle East.
Muslims pray five times a day at the Oakland Islamic Center. The men and women line up to begin the 1 o'clock service. Like many here, the Egyptian leader of the mosque has family back home. He says he has two daughters back in Egypt and hopes the new government is civil and people can practice their freedom. He doesn't believe this is only a youth revolution because it was Egyptians of all ages working together. In the women's section upstairs, Egyptian immigrants say they've kept in constant contact with family during the rapid changes.
We're so very happy that Mubarak stepped down finally, and they are so excited and anxious about the future.
The Oasis Cafe near the mosque is a place to gather before and after prayer. On this day, two longtime friends from Jordan and Yemen share their thoughts.
And Yemen is a bit more shaky than Egypt or Jordan. Yemeni people pride themselves of having weapons. So if the same thing happens in Yemen, I'm afraid it will be a lot more bloodshed.
I have family in Jordan who, the same thing, you know, no one can talk, you know. People, you know, they're going to like it or not, the change will happen, and they have to deal with it. And in my opinion, no one should be afraid of the democracy.
The future for Egypt remains uncertain as uproar and rebellion begin to catch on in other countries. And this is clearly on the minds of people we met.
Our problem is we expect other people to do for us what we need to do for ourselves. The Egyptian people did this for themselves.
Now, if the situation changed there, it will be another America, you know, to us. People will no longer need to migrate, you know.
I hope that my country will develop and to overcome all this obstacle which happened in the past and to be one of the developed country because it deserves that.
This is Emily Bender reporting for CNS News.
For 6 days and nights in early February, thousands of mourners filled the Fresno Convention Center to honor General Vang Pao, a hero and patriarch of the Hmong community.
It's not a happy day if very, very, very sad day.
The Hmong are an ethnic minority from the mountainous regions of China and Southeast Asia.
We live on a mountain, on the jungle. We never see electricity.
There are now more than 200,000 Hmong living in the United States, many of them in Fresno, California. They revere Vang Pao as the man who brought them to America. The general was recruited by the United States in the 1960s to lead a guerrilla army against communist forces in Laos.
He saved thousands and thousands of American lives by pulling North Vietnamese troops into Laos where they didn't go into South Vietnam.
Hundreds of thousands of Hmong fought, and many died under Vang Pao's command during what became known as the CIA's secret war.
I was a soldier with General Vang Pao. I lost my general.
He was beloved by the Hmong and Americans who fought alongside him, but others considered him a warlord. As recently as 2007, he was accused of plotting a coup against the Laotian government, charges that were later dropped. For those who traveled from around the world to say their final prayers at his funeral, Vang Pao was a savior.
If we don't have him, we're not able to enter to the United States. He's very grateful for all the Hmong people.
Vang Pao died of pneumonia in January at the age of 81. And in this final ceremony, the Hmong say, his soul was guided to the spirit world. This is Lauren Rosenfeld reporting for CNS News.
Sixteen-year-old Lauren Dangerfield is one of 20,000 students who depend on the Muni.
I catch the bus around 3 to 4 times a day, or sometimes 5, depending on where I'm going.
In the last year and a half, muni passes for youth went from $10 to $15 to $20 a month. When Lauren couldn't afford the increase, she would sneak onto the back of the bus.
And I didn't really like to do that, but it was kind of what I had to do to make sure I can get to school or get to work.
Over a year ago, youth commissioners like Happy Yang worked to address the need.
So we wrote a resolution urging the San Francisco Board of Supervisors to create these half-price monthly passes called Youth Lifeline for low-income young people.
The Board of Supervisors approved the proposal, slashing the cost of a pass to $10 a month. But since there was no one to manage the program, the promise of a reduced fare never materialized. Now the board passed a new resolution to allow low-income students to ride for free.
But since we're talking about simply printing 12,000 free passes each month, April, May, and June, it's a lot easier to implement.
It's really thanks to the pressure that the community has put up that we're in a position in which we're really, really, really close to getting this done.
Matias Mormino works with low-income families.
The muni is the only way that they can get out of the neighborhoods in which maybe the schools are underperforming and to really get out to better schools and have an opportunity to go to a better future.
If all goes well, 12,000 low-income students will be riding the muni free starting April 1st. This is Nancy Lopez for CNS News.
I'm at a bus stop in the East Bay where I'm asking people what they would do if they couldn't afford to ride the bus.
I'd be stranded. I wouldn't be able to get around.
I would probably walk home or take a bike.
I would probably be cut off from the rest of the world.
I would probably bike home and to school.
Not being able to afford the bus seems like it would affect a lot of people.
Thanks, Patty. Coming up, Christopher Connolly asks why the sea otter population is shrinking. Jake Schoniker takes a look at the mysterious disappearance of honeybees, but now Becca Friedman travels to a Marin County community battling a law that helps cell phone companies build towers.
At a recent meeting of San Rafael homeowners, Ray Lorber told his neighbors what might happen to their community.
What is this project all about? They're putting in nodes, they call them. Up at the end of the street is where they're going to place the tower.
Lorber says frustration began when residents noticed spray paint that marked utilities along one street in the neighborhood.
The white marks here are where the actual digging is going to occur. As you see, they go all the way down 3 blocks to Cedar Hill.
When Lorber learned that construction of a cell tower might begin mid-January, he took immediate action.
I called the police department just in case I have rioting neighbors trying to stop the backhoe diggers from ruining our street. Come Monday morning, nothing happened.
So Lorber met with contractors and city officials. At the neighborhood association meeting, there were plenty of questions.
What is the health impact from all these different stations and whatever?
The federal government said there's no problem there, so it's not an issue.
Neighbors didn't seem convinced, but a representative of Extinet, the contractor, says they shouldn't worry.
A baby monitor has a higher RF signal, has a higher power emission than an antenna, even a macro antenna.
Federal legislation agrees and mandates cell tower construction. AT&T says it's a complex process.
Wireless infrastructure isn't magic. It takes scientists, it takes engineers, it takes people with a real background in the technology to do the research and to do the science to figure out where an antenna should be placed.
How can the Public Utilities Commission authorize installation of 60-foot towers in my yard?
But they can, and that has Lorber upset.
I have no rights. It can go in. How I feel. It should be stopped.
And to Lorber's relief, it did stop. Ultimately, the contractors decided not to build the tower on his street. But public utilities warn the demand for quality cell phone reception means construction will continue somewhere else. This is Becca Friedman reporting for CNS News.
It's mid-February in the Central Valley, and it's time for the annual almond bloom.
This valley produces 80% of the world's almonds. It's a $1 billion industry and California's top agricultural export. And it all depends on one little insect, the honeybee.
Almonds are one of the crops that have to have bees for pollination.
That demand gives local beekeepers like Orrin Johnson their biggest paycheck of the year. and they go to great lengths to have their bees ready for the almonds.
We're artificially feeding them and stimulating the hive earlier than normal to get the queen laying coming out of winter.
The demand is so great at this time of year that beekeepers from all over the country flock to California. But it's not going to be a big payday for everyone. Eric Olson shipped thousands of hives here back in December.
Excellent hives, just jam-packed full, and by the 4th of January, they had just disappeared. They didn't die in the hives, they didn't die in the yard, they just left.
Olson lost 60% of his bees, and what's worse, no one seems to know why. It appears to be part of an industry-wide crisis known as colony collapse disorder, or CCD. Researchers across the country are searching for the cause.
We have not found the smoking gun. We've not figured out what CCD is. It's probably a combination of many factors, including, you know, nutrition, pests, and diseases.
Those factors have threatened bee health for decades. But in recent years, the death rate has skyrocketed. 30% of U.S. bee colonies die each winter.
Any other type of farming, an almond grower, a cattleman, if you lost 30% of your trees or your cattle, you're probably out of business that year.
As the almonds start to bloom this year, scientists are racing to find the cause and the cure for colony collapse. But without answers, beekeepers can only try to keep their bees healthy and hope for the best. This is Jake Schoniker for CNS News.
Well, bees are in bad shape, but so are otters. But what is an otter?
An otter is a mammal. It's a mustelid.
It's kind of fat, and it has like a flipper in the back.
Kind of furry. Lies on its back, eating, I think, like abalones or something.
They look like dogs, a little bit, but in the ocean.
Although they've made a comeback over the past three decades, the last few years have been tough for the southern sea otter.
The population has actually been declining, and we found a record number of otters dead. I mean, you'll often see gulls with them.
Steve Shemick runs the Otter Project, an advocacy group based in Monterey. He says the trend is a warning for humans, too.
We're eating the same seafood that the otters are eating. So the otters are telling us that there's something fundamentally wrong as far as disease and pollutants in our ocean.
Every year, the U.S. Geological Survey runs an otter census. In 2010, it turned up just over 2,700 otters, a population too small to guarantee survival. They also found over 300 dead otters, 70 more than a year earlier. Tim Tinker heads up the count. When asked what accounts for the increase in otter deaths, he says it's complicated.
It's hard to actually pin it to any one factor.
One cause that's on the rise? Shark attacks. Sharks don't eat otters, but they do eat seals and sea lions, who share the same coastal habitat. It's a deadly case of mistaken identity.
Otters just happen to be in the wrong place and at the wrong time, as it were.
But the bigger issues they face come from their neighbors on shore.
There are a number of infectious diseases and also pollutants that can get into the nearshore environment and end up in that food web.
Otters sit at the top of the food web where toxins are more concentrated, making them more susceptible to disease. Another troubling fact from last year's otter census, more fertile females died and pup numbers are down. Not much can be done about shark attacks, but Steve Shemick says there's plenty we can do to help these endangered critters.
We can improve their habitat with marine protected areas, then we can work generally to improve water quality.
With these improvements and with more research, both Shemick and Tinker are hopeful that the southern sea otter will bounce back. This is Christopher Connolly reporting for CNS News.
Otters, bees, and video stores? What do they all have in common? We'll find out as Alyssa Fattini looks at how technology is pushing video stores to the brink of extinction. But first, two stories. In Berkeley, police are cracking down on massage parlors that are diversifying their services. And in Oakland, a high-end approach to the type of business most neighborhoods tend to reject. Ted Troutman reports.
On Valentine's Day, Nina Joyner opened her first brick-and-mortar business in Oakland. But not everyone in the neighborhood wants what she has to sell.
You're able to come in and find any and everything, in addition to the normal sex store, if you will, or intimacy items that are in the store as well.
Joyner is the owner of Feelmore 510, a new adult store in Oakland with a progressive philosophy.
This is one of those spaces where people should not be judgmental coming in here. That is not tolerated.
But Fillmore's uptown location puts it within 500 feet of youth organizations like Youth Radio, as well as the Oakland School for the Arts, where Don Harris serves as executive director.
It's a public charter school, grades 6 through 12. They all audition to get in here, even students as young as 10 years old.
Opponents of the store expressed their concerns at a planning commission hearing in December.
Some of those clientele may prey on our young people who are in that area during the same hours of operation.
If this is not what you would want your kids or grandkids to see on their way to work or on their way to school, then please don't let our kids see it either.
Harris does not share their worries.
My own daughter goes here, so I have the same investment in this neighborhood as any other parent. We have really responsible kids. And as long as their families aren't worried about it, I don't feel an excessive need to protect them from types of stores that are all over town.
And I actually did reach out to Oakland School of the Arts.
She explained to me what it was, and we wanted to let you know that, you know, we're coming, want to be good neighbors, and, you know, answer any questions you might have or allay any fears you might have. And I believe they were moving into what was an empty storefront, and I think an empty storefront is kind of a bigger problem than a store.
If we're talking about children, I'm a presence for the children to see, especially brown kids, that this is a brown woman that is opening a business.
So far, Joyner tends the shop herself, 6 days a week.
Well, we're open from Monday through Saturday. My mother said I shouldn't open on Sunday, just out of the Sabbath.
This is Ted Trotman, reporting for CNS News.
Sally Hannah Ryan and Marty Conrad are next-door neighbors in South Berkeley. In early February, they helped the city close down the Sunflower Wellness Center, a massage parlor on their block.
A friend of mine 2 years ago noticed the ad in the Express newspaper on the sex page ad where these massage parlors that are really brothels are advertised, and she thought, that's across the street from where Sally lives.
I started noticing just exactly what kind of traffic was coming and going. All male, no females. I didn't think this was in the up and up.
The city began investigating the business after receiving numerous calls and emails from neighbors.
The report went to code enforcement. That indicated that the business was not being used, at least by this particular employee, for the purpose that it said it was.
The Sunflower Wellness Center is just one of many largely Asian-operated massage parlors suspected of offering more than just massages. And that's why the district attorney has put in place a county-wide anti-human trafficking effort.
When you're looking at these houses of prostitution, if it involves foreign nationals, then one of the next questions we have to ask is, are they victims of human trafficking?
Though not convinced trafficking was an issue at the Sunflower Wellness Center, the police say prostitution was and is in many Berkeley locations.
Historically, we've always done a couple investigations a year.
People want sex, and if they can't get it one way, they'll buy it. So I think it probably should be legalized.
But with no immediate plans to legalize prostitution, the city has begun to investigate at least 20 massage parlors. This is Whitney Pennington reporting for CNS News.
They don't make any good Western movies now. They do.
Video Maniacs owner Henry Buchan has watched as a number of video stores in the Bay Area have closed their doors for good, and he is now fearful for the fate of his own store.
To be truth, honestly, there is, I think video stores will be around for next maybe 3 to 5 years at most.
The culprit? Movie magnate Netflix, which allows customers to stream movies online or have them delivered directly to their homes for a low price. Netflix now has over 10 million subscribers and has delivered more than 1 billion DVDs, forcing even the biggies like Blockbuster and Hollywood Video into bankruptcy. Since Netflix's launch in 1997, over 10,000 video stores have closed across the country. But according to Buchan, there are some critical parts of the video store experience that even Netflix can't replicate.
Customer service, because they will not be able to replace that part of it, the human aspect of it.
Sometimes people actually don't want to just take a movie and go home. They want to talk about it. They want to say, oh, I just saw this yesterday and I really loved it. Thank you. Or do you have anything similar?
Former video store owner and entrepreneur Stuart Scorman is trying to preserve the video store experience through his new website, Clerk Dogs. Through the website, a staff of film experts and former video store clerks provide custom-tailored movie recommendations.
Let's just say you want to find a match to the Philadelphia Story, whether you press match or you want to find matches.
And then what we do is we build a whole world around the Philadelphia Story.
And that's all written by a human person that often was a former video store clerk.
While initiatives like Scorman's may help keep the spirit of video stores alive, for some customers, there will never be anything like the real thing.
I find that I can spend an hour just wandering around. You know, just looking and looking. It's like being in a library, kind of looking for that right book. It's like that with movies for me.
This is Alyssa Fattini reporting for CNS News.
Well, we've just seen that video stores are in danger of being shut down. So what will you miss most about renting movies from the store?
There's an social exchange between the people who work in the store, even the owner, and we who visit, and they make recommendations about what's good and what's bad, and that will be missed.
I start being able to go in there and physically, you know, to rent for however long, whichever movie, be able to browse and go around and be able to really physically get in there and look at the movies and be able to really connect.
It wouldn't really affect me. I would not really care if all the stores just vanished.
It just goes to show that technology is really creeping up on us. Carl?
Thanks, Patty. In our final segment, Justin Jewell goes along with some real-life superheroes as they fight crime on the streets of San Francisco. But first, Roberto Daza takes us to AT&T Park to meet the newest member of the Giants, and Kevin Fixler reports from Berkeley as baseball fans mourn the loss of a team that's been around for more than a century.
Cal's baseball team continues to practice, despite the university saying the team has no future. But feelings around the issue are beginning to boil over.
My emotions are obviously disappointed and angry. I have a lot of sympathy and empathy for our players. But the heartbreaking part is it took us a long time to build the program to be a playoff contender on a yearly basis, and that's what we are. And to see that all come crashing down and all at once is difficult to watch.
Entering his 12th year as coach, David Esker told the media in early February that while the program fights for its life, this season remains its top priority.
Given the circumstances, all we can focus on is getting this team prepared and focused to play, have its best year. And if it's going to be the last year at this point in time in the history of Cal baseball, we feel we can give them a hell of a team.
University spokesperson Dan Mogiloff says the controversy over Cal athletics is rooted in Berkeley's long-term financial survival.
It comes as part of a process of stepping back and saying, what do we need to do to put our house in order so we can weather this storm? It was a department that was requiring $10 to $15 million a year in institutional allocations. And in the current climate, that's not sustainable by any stretch of the imagination.
I would say that I've been a bit jaded by the misleading nature of the university in this process.
Baseball alum Doug Nickel is one of the leaders of Save Cal Sports, an organization that has raised more than $13 million.
We've heard a lot of people talking about wanting to throw away their Cal stuff, and Cal did not make this decision. A few people at Cal made this decision. So there's no reason for people to hate the university. This is just a time where we need to get together. It's more important now more than ever to do that.
Nickel says he'll settle for nothing short of reinstatement, but it's possible the time for that may have already run out. This is Kevin Fixler reporting for CNS News.
Swing, and there's a shot deep to left field, way back there. Adios!
Thousands flocked to AT&T Park for the Giants' annual fan fest to see their favorite players. Many of them eager to show their appreciation for the team's World Series victory last year. But the longest line wasn't for an autograph. It was to catch a glimpse of the World Series championship trophy.
I came here to see the trophy so I can get as close as possible to it before I can never get a chance to do it again. So.
I would have missed this day unless I was locked up or dead.
Taking a picture with the World Series trophy is everything.
Let's keep it moving, please. Thank y'all.
The trophy is the biggest rock star that we've ever had. So we're calling her Tiffany because she's made by Tiffany & Company. When we went to New York, it was all first class.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're
we're pleased to announce that the World Series champion San Francisco Giants trophy is one of our guests on board today.
We'll have a driver wherever we're going. We have an official Toyota Trophy Tour truck. There's security that goes with her all the time. Never alone. There'll always be two or three people with the trophy. It's taken over our lives in the best possible way.
But Tiffany isn't just affecting the lives of her entourage.
We were taking a picture with the trophy.
And then I showed her the ring and I asked her if she would marry me. No better place than right here in San Francisco. Giants trophy. Come on. Where else? Golden Gate Bridge has been done.
People haven't waited for 56 years to see a player. The trophy is something that kind of resonates with everybody. No matter what age you are, you appreciate the trophy.
Thank you once again for attending the 2000.
This is Roberto Daza, reporting for CNS News.
You've seen superheroes in movies and in comic books, but how about in your own neighborhood? If you could have a superhero power, what would it be?
My superpower would be super strength, because, I don't know, I just wonder how it would be to be able to pick up, like, huge stuff.
I'd probably want to read people's minds. Flying, invisibility, or read people's minds.
So we're here on Mission and 16th Street in San Francisco's Mission District, and we're about to meet up with some real-life superheroes. These are guys who are really into comic books and also really into social justice. And so they dress up like their favorite comic book character and they go out and stop crime. And we're just going to peruse the neighborhood tonight, see if we can find some criminals.
Yeah. Hi, you're a reporter?
Yes, I'm Justin.
How you doing, man?
Nice to meet you.
So let me give you the rounds real fast.
Yeah.
This right here is Justified. This is Kingsnake. And this is Nightbug.
And this is Motormouth. I found him on the Real Life Superhero Registry, which, since its inception in 2008, has grown from a handful of people to over 200 members across the world. They're all part of the Real Life Superhero movement, and their mission is to protect.
And it's just people trying to take back their communities, take back their streets, trying to make the world that much better of a place.
Which they do, to some degree. On our patrol, we helped out a drunk.
Is everything okay? You okay?
We fielded questions from the public.
What gives you the right?
And we even chased down a man who was allegedly threatening his girlfriend.
Okay, let's go. Come on, let's go.
Which didn't work out so well because of the police.
Hey, Kingsnake, can you kind of tell us what happened with the cops back there?
Well, they were kind of being hard asses about the entire mask deal. They claimed that there was a municipal code that did not allow for masks.
The cops were also upset about these heavy gloves and about the 950,000-volt taser knuckles the superheroes wear.
Our relationship with the police department is tenuous at best.
Motormouth has been arrested more than once and assaulted by criminals as well, but he remains undaunted.
I'm looking into getting a holster and carrying a pepper ball gun. I'm also presently working on building a Captain America shield.
This is Justin Jewell reporting for CNS News.
Well, if you're ever in trouble, you know who to call.
Thanks for watching this edition of CNS News. I'm Carl Nassman.
And I'm Patty Espinosa. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.